Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Jonathan Bennett joins me. We're going to be talking about the Purple Foundation. They've brought together various projects like QEMU and OpenWRT and are helping them along. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Jonathan Bennett. Episode 405 for September 27th, 2016. The Purple Foundation. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneEngine.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day, not aware of it, projects you may want to download right after the show and go play with it. Unless you're in your car, please don't download anything while you're in your car unless you're the passenger. I'll just keep making that longer and longer in every show. I make this stuff up. It's all I have to do. It's really cool. Joining me today is Jonathan Bennett. Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Jonathan, you know, as I'm listening to the shows that were made while I was gone, usually horizontal or something in a hospital bed or a physical rehab bed, as I'm now catching up with all these shows, and you were like almost every show, was it? It's pretty close, right?
Oh, not quite. Not quite that often. I've joked that I kind of cheat because I run my own business, so I set my own hours. So every time the email comes, can you be available? It's like, well, yeah, sure, I can. I can be there anytime.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, well, it was great having you provide your assistance as often as you did. And also today, no exception to that. Just a little bit of locations here. I am once again in my brother's den, sitting right next to a pool table that you can't see. Hopefully no sun today. So it won't be like, I think halfway through last week's show, it looked like I was participating in an Instagram filter because it was so so contrasty from the light side to the dark side. I'm sure Darth Vader said that as well. No, where am I going with that? And where are we? So I'm just north of Olympia, Washington. Where are you? Somewhere in Oklahoma, I presume.
I'm here in the open source lair, the home office here in Lawton, Oklahoma.
Very cool. Any recent earthquakes?
There was one 3 or 4 weeks ago, but nothing major since then.
Awesome. Awesome. So this show isn't about us, but we have to host the show, so we have to at least get a little bit in there. This show is about various and exciting open source projects and the people that make them happen. Today is no exception. Eric Schultz is going to be coming on in a few minutes. He's the community manager of the Purple Foundation. That's spelled P-R-P-L in good online tradition where they drop a lot of vowels like Flickr and everybody else. And so Mostly Purple seems to be about things like QEMU and Purple WRT, which is a fork of OpenWRT, which I'm familiar with, some specialized projects about virtualization and security, and another project they're calling the Carrier Interest Group. I understand you have some familiarity with Purple. Why don't you tell us, without it replacing Eric entirely, hopefully, tell us a little bit about Purple and how you came about to be participating in it.
Yes, I'll take the next 30 minutes and tell you all about Purple. No, I do a little bit of work with OpenWRT, OpenWrite, and maintain a couple packages. And about a year ago, Purple put on a OpenWRT conference out in Dublin. And I didn't think I was going to make it, but I just kind of threw out this throwaway proposal. You know, I'll come and I'll talk about this. And Eric emails me back and says, I like it. You should really come and do it. We'll pay your way to get out there. So that was my first interaction with Eric, and spent some time with him at the conference and really enjoyed him. And then got the opportunity to interact with him just a little bit more and invited him on the show. And here he is.
And so what is it you've done with OpenWRT, or I guess as they're calling it, the Purple WRT?
I maintain, let's see, Nano is probably the big one. And then the other project I work with, FWNOP, I've maintained and have written some code to get it running on OpenWRT routers.
Oh, that's awesome. So we could have your fantastic not port knocking protocol, but the next generation port knocking protocol. And you can go back and listen. Do you remember what show number that was?
I have no idea.
Oh, no, see, you should keep that memorized. So when you're at a party, not a good party, but a party where a lot of nerds are, you can say, hey, go listen to me at twitch.tv/flush275 or whatever it is.
I'll write it on a sticky note and put it right
there
up here.
It should be on your business cards. Yeah, there we go. Well, that's enough chit-chatting back and forth. I think Eric's in the wings waiting for us to bring him on. So let's go ahead and bring on Eric. Eric Schultz, welcome to the show.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
And where are you speaking to us from?
I am in Appleton, Wisconsin, actually, at the co-working space I work at.
Oh, very cool. I have not been. I think I've flown over Appleton. I think the closest I've gotten is I was in Milwaukee once. And I was up in, where else was I? I think I was in a couple places there. And I remember flying into, no, I guess it wasn't flying into Milwaukee. Anyway, so now I'm misremembering my history, so we'll stop at that. So why don't you give us the 30,000-foot view? What is the Purple Foundation? What kinds of projects is it bringing together? And maybe even a bit of history. How did it come into existence?
Purple Foundation came into existence, I'm thinking it's about 2 years ago now. It was a collaboration primarily when it started of Imagination Technologies, who owns the MIPS processor framework, and some of the companies related to them that use it, such as Qualcomm, Broadcom, Lantik, and some other companies. And over time, Purple has become an open source, open standards foundation. Primarily focused on things that are kind of related to MIPS, but not specifically. And very much our goal is to broaden open source within these companies and work together with the companies and open source communities.
Very cool. You know, last week I was speculating what the heck is MIPS, and Guillermo gave me that it's still used in routers and stuff. Mm-hmm. I remember it being like a DEC product originally? And so how did this other organization get a hold of it?
I wasn't around at all at that time, but I believe Imagination bought it from, I think, MIPS Technologies or something like that.
Okay. Back when you were a tyke.
Yes,
I'm an
pretty
old
much.
Guy. I'm an old guy, and I remember all this stuff going by eventually, you know. And unfortunately, my memory has a half-life, and I think it's somewhere on the order of 2 hours. So I don't think I remember much about this. Mm-hmm. So you, primarily MIPS stuff, but you said you're branching out. Do you want to talk about some of the projects that specifically Purple's been involved in?
Yeah.
I mentioned a few of them at the top of the show, but I don't know if that's comprehensive or not.
Yeah, those are the big things. I can go into a little detail. Purple WRT is actually not a fork of OpenWRT. When we originally started, we were thinking might be. Really, it's just a place for companies that are involved in OpenWRT to get together and talk about projects and issues that are relevant to them, and then to try to build relationships with the OpenWRT and lead communities. One of the things we really started in the last 6 months is we're working on funding projects that are related to OpenWRT that are valuable both to our members and also a number of and the OpenWRT community as a whole. We started our first round of funding. It was in April or May, and we funded four projects. The projects we funded were there was a project that involved scheduling internet access, adding mm-hmm. support to Lucy for scheduling internet access based upon MAC address. This was of interest to a few smaller companies that ship routers and sell them to families and things like that. We funded another project that related to scheduling Wi-Fi access. Similar kind of concept, support for it in Lucy and actually make it possible. Those are some smaller projects we're funding, but were of interest to the community and were suggested to us. The bigger projects we're funding right now relate to the TR-069 protocol. It's a remote management protocol primarily used by telecoms. A number of our newer members, Soft at Home and ADB, they sell to cable companies, they sell to telecom providers, and we are looking that we may have some larger carriers that are going to be interested in joining Purple or going to join Purple very soon. And we're funding support for adding TR69 to OpenWRT and LEAD. And we are we're funding that project, facilitating that project. We brought a number of companies together at a meeting in Paris, along with Luka Perkov, who is a core team member of OpenWRT, as well as Felix Fietkow, who is a committer to LEAD, and got them together to kind of sit down in a room, talk about the technical issues that are involved, the business issues. I mean, we don't want to create something that is not of use to businesses, but at the same time, we need to make sure that it is valuable and doesn't, you know, overlook the needs of the community. We don't want to have anything that is that ignores one side or the other.
Now, you know, this show's been going on for a really long time, and I don't remember whether we've actually interviewed the OpenWRT people at all. And I'd be doing Googles right now to answer the question. That's how long. Again, my memory's got a half-life of a couple of hours. So tell us, back up a step. What is OpenWRT? And let me first explain that I think what it is some application that you can run on a small router that basically provides captive portals, so you can share your internet with, say, public customers if you were a restaurant or something. Is that close?
That's one use of OpenWRT. OpenWRT is really, I would almost call it a meta distribution of Linux. If you want to build a version of Linux for routers, but usually embedded in general, that has particular features built in, that it's a really great platform for doing that, it's a lot of fun to work with, and it's of interest to our members because our members, many of them distribute a version of OpenWRT that for their customers that they've modified in some way, that they've added additional features on top of, or has a particular configuration that's of use to them. So that's kind of how why we're interested in that.
And as I recall, at least when I was looking at it, and we're talking, my goodness, we're talking probably 10, 12 years ago, it was sort of not web-based, but it was sort of text-based, where you would fill in various things in curses forms, as I recall. Has it gotten smarter? Has it gotten more GUI over the years?
For building a version of OpenWRT, really you do tend to use the command line because it actually uses the build root project and it connects to some of the menu configuration, the curses configuration for the Linux kernel, and it combines the two into, it's a pretty elegant system once you actually start to understand it. It takes a little while to wrap your mind around, but it's pretty elegant. There is a web UI for managing your router. It's called Lucy. Some companies use it and customize it. One company that I know a little bit about, and we actually funded their work. They worked on the scheduling for the internet access for different devices. They actually use it as part of their of what they ship to customers. I believe it's a Nanobox. Other companies, they build a different web administration platform on top of it, and that works for them. So it's super flexible, which makes it somewhat difficult to explain what it does. Now, OpenWRT and LEAD, which is a fork of OpenWRT, they both release binaries, so you don't have to build it yourself, and it has some of that stuff built in for average people that are just want to download it. It's still not the, you know, you're still going to have to be somewhat technical, but it makes it a little bit easier if you don't want to have to set up a build environment and all those kind of things.
Okay, so there are some companies that are actually shipping devices with OpenWRT on them already. Is that the case, and what is their purpose in doing that? What do they gain with that?
most of the I can say that Intel, who bought Lantique, Qualcomm, and Broadcom all ship a board support package, which they actually give to customers, which is based on OpenWRT. And then companies, say, making routers or whatnot, they then often take that. They have, I believe, most of those companies also have different board support packages if you want to not, you know, you have a different set of software that isn't based on OpenWRT, but all of them do have a board support package that's based on OpenWRT. And the reason they use it is because there's been such a strong community. It's easy to maintain on their end. They know that there's going to be improvements over time. There's going to be bug fixes. It's a good community. So that's kind of why companies do it. It's a quick way. I don't want to say it's a quick way, but it is kind of a quick way to get up to speed as quickly as possible and have a pretty solid embedded operating system to start off with.
Okay, we've got a question from the chat room. Emily yep. The Strange wants to know, do you have to ask your ISP to be able to connect a WRT router and replace the one they gave to you?
I'm not so sure. In the United States, I know you don't. I do have an OpenWRT-based router, and that one is a that connects behind the cable modem. I don't know about other countries. I'm not exactly sure.
Okay. Tell us a little bit more about OpenWRT versus LEED. What is LEED? Who forked it, and why does it matter?
That's kind of a difficult question. we're very friendly with both groups. You would have to really talk to the groups to understand the interest in forking. I think it's kind of goals and organization and some of those things that people just kind of disagreed on. I suspect at some point they're going to come together, and we hope that the OpenWRT Summit, the second one, which we're organizing in, which is on October 13th in Berlin, it will be a good opportunity for the groups to get together. I mean, I don't know if they're going to do that, but I hope that it is a good opportunity because many of the members on both sides are based in Europe.
Go ahead and tell us a little bit more about the OpenWRT Summits. I remember last year was the first one. If you want to give us a little bit of history and tell us what you're expecting for next year.
Yeah. Last year was the first OpenWRT Summit. We Purple was the main sponsor. I was organizing it. We got about 80-some people there. It's a free event. We certainly don't charge. We host it at the Embedded Linux Conference Europe. Last year that was in Dublin. This year it's in Berlin. We have grown significantly since last year. I think last year was certainly a success. This year we're going to have even more people. We right now had about 170 to 180 registrations. It's a free event, so we appreciate that probably not all those people are going to show up last year, and that's quite normal for free events like this. But we certainly are going to have some growth over last year. We've got a great set of speakers this year, I think. It's a little bit different mix than last year. I think we have people looking at the broad range of things related to embedded devices. Things like the issues, like the best practices for using UBI on flash memory, and we have people talking about how to work with the community, a company that uses OpenWRT, how do you actually work with the community and do it properly? We have people who are going to talk about reproducible builds that were done originally in Debian, but talking about them in OpenWRT. And then we're going to have a lot of things, people just talking about the things that they're doing in OpenWRT. So I think it's going to be a really, really great event where we have free food and we are going to have dinner and a social event afterwards. So I would encourage anybody who's interested to go to openwrtsummit.org and sign up. We're certainly getting close to capacity, so I would encourage you to do that as soon as possible. And if you just were going to go and decided not to, please tell us so we can have that space reserved for someone else.
You know, I love all these URLs that would obviously have a reason to have a hyphen in them that don't have hyphens in them. You know, in the early days of the web, we did proper hyphenation because we ran into things like, I'm sure some of you out there that have been around for a while know that there are a few URLs that have multiple interpretations because they aren't hyphenated. But that would that particular URL that you just mentioned would screams for a hyphen in it. But then you end up having to say, you know, openwrt-summit.org, and then it's like hyphen. What's that? Is that like minus? Is that a dash? What is that? You know. So I completely understand, but I think we are so underusing the hyphen. We should probably do that more. My favorite one is actually one Tom Phoenix coworker. One of my first employee, actually. Tom Phoenix helped me teach Perl classes back in the 90s and even through some of the last few years. I came up with this wonderful one for Super Bowl and said it could be about a site that's really for owl enthusiasts that would be Superb Owls. And so it's like, you know, the hyphen can sometimes clear things up. So I have a few things I want to talk to you. So, Eric, have you been involved with the project since the beginning? And if not, how did you get involved?
Which project are you talking about? OpenWRT? Purple. Oh, Purple. Yeah, I was there very early on. They were looking for a community manager, somebody who kind of understood open source and understood open source norms, you know, the experience with open source, and also had a technical side. When they got started, there were a lot of people who were kind of in the they generally thought it was a good idea, but they weren't exactly sure how to go about making it happen. So I've tried to provide that to Purple, and it's gone reasonably well, I'd have to say.
And what is your background in open source that brought you to this?
My background in open source, I was actually involved in a project that was started by Microsoft, was CoApp, which is it's a package management system for Windows, never kind of took off the way we had hoped, but I was involved in that, and that was actually a project that was mostly funded by Microsoft, but was through a foundation called Outer Curve Foundation. And I worked at Outer Curve Foundation, and Outer Curve Foundation started to wind down. So I was looking for something, and Purple was there. So
awesome, cool, and a couple more projects. You know, OpenWRT, we talked a lot about that, but QEMU. How is Purple involved with QEMU? And can you also back us up a step and describe what QEMU is?
Yeah. QEMU or QEMU, I'm not sure the proper pronunciation yet. Purple has been, I wouldn't say we've been as active as we thought we were going to be. A number of the people that are at Imagination who work on the MIPS support have committed support. But Purple hasn't been super active in that. That said, we are looking to use it more for our board farm project, which I can talk about in a little bit, which is related to our OpenWRT work.
Well, yeah, go ahead. Talk about it.
Yeah, Board Farm is actually something that was created by Qualcomm Atheros, who is a member of Purple. And it's an automated testing framework for OpenWRT routers. It's really for any kind of embedded system, but works really well on OpenWRT. So we contribute to that project, and we're also building a automated testing lab, effectively, for devices that are contributed by members of the community, by members of Purple, anybody to we'll do automated testing against daily against OpenWRT and Lead, and you know, see if anything breaks overnight, things like that, and make sure that features continue to work over time. I mean, certainly that's something that would, I think, bring benefit to the community, and we've been trying to do that. So we currently have two boards set up. I've been trying to do it a little bit on the side, as you know, not when I've had time. Hopefully with OpenWRT Summit, once we get done with that, I'll have a little more time to actually focus on that a little bit. So we're adding more boards as we go, and we welcome the community contributing them so they can contact me if they're interested in that. We're trying to work with both the OpenWRT team and Lead to see how we can best do this so that the results get to them and they're valuable.
Well, is the OpenWRT implementation running as ARM or running as MIPS or something not like either of those?
For the testing we're running, it runs on the actual board. So it's whatever the board is. In our case, all the ones we've had so far are MIPS. They don't have to be. They can be anything you want, really. We actually use Raspberry Pis, which are ARM-based, but do come from, they have Broadcom chips, which is also a purple member. And we use those for actually, running some of the tests that connect to the board. Because you actually, to do high-quality embedded operating system testing to see the boots, you have to do it on the actual hardware, which mm-hmm. is actually kind of surprisingly difficult. And prior to board farm, there wasn't a very good way to do this. Now you can do automated tests. You can actually connect to the board and do some interesting tests yourself. So you connect it like the WAN, the LAN port, connect to actual pieces of hardware that are, in our case, Raspberry Pis. In the future, we'd like to move them to virtualized servers, which would cut down on maintenance and make it a little bit simpler to do. But for now, it's working pretty well.
So I'm about to demonstrate both the extent and the limitedness of my geekiness. So is there something in the boot sequence that has been specifically put in there so that you can flag a sort of testing debug, or you're running under a harness sort of mode that enables this?
No. Actually, that's part of the joy of it, and the reason it works so well is that it's not done with testing. There is the bootloader, and we use the bootloader. It's usually U-boot, at least it has been to this date, and then we use that using a serial connection to flash a new version, and then we connect through. Through the serial port and run commands on the chip. We boot it. We see if the results are what we expect them to be. And then using the LAN and the WAN, you can transmit data through to kind of see what kind of throughput you get. Does it actually work at all? What kind of do you have any ping loss and things like that? So it's a little bit hard to explain, but it really mostly uses shell commands, honestly.
But it's something that sort of came with, came out of the box with the firmware or the software so that you could, in fact, do this stuff. This isn't something you've had to trick it into doing.
No, you haven't had to trick it into doing. It's really just using the basic serial connection that you can use to get access to a shell on on most embedded device Linux devices. You can do that, and we just use that serial connection and run commands in an automated fashion. So really, it's almost like it's based in Python, but really it's just running shell commands. And we then check: does the result do what we expect it to be? Does it boot? Do we get the numbers we expect them to be? And then when we need to test other things like the network support, and do we then contact other devices that are connected and then say, oh hey, start up a netperf session and run it through the router and see what happens.
Okay. Great.
I don't know if that makes sense, but...
No, that does. It does. And then on a completely different topic, because I sort of ran out of questions about what I wanted to ask about booting up on the board. But actually, I do want to step back just one step. And so how would... You said that QEMU is related to the board farm,
yeah,
but I'm not quite sure
bit.
I caught the connection there. What is the overlap there?
Yeah, the connection is in the future we want to move to a virtualized environment instead of having... for the LAN and the WAN and whatever's connected, they're currently using Raspberry Pis. That works perfectly well, but maintenance wise, it's a little bit of a pain, and it isn't as robust as I think we'd like. So if we could build that into a pretty beefy server, and then build like QEMU virtual machines and have them run there, you can pass in the LAN and the WAN to that and then run the test that way, which would minimize the amount of hardware you would need.
And this would be QEMU emulating either an ARM or a MIPS underneath running on a host machine that would be running x86 then, right?
Probably, yeah, something like that.
Okay. And I also wanted to make that clear for our audience that QEMU, unlike something like Docker, has the ability to emulate entirely foreign processors. I was running x86 programs on my OS X box before the Intel chips were brought in, back when we were running 68K or whatever the previous thing was on that. So that was, I was using a sort of a branded version of QEMU for that. So on an entirely different tack for a bit. I think a couple times you've mentioned carrier level or carrier grade. For those that aren't familiar with that terminology, can you explain more of what that might mean?
Carrier grade is really, and this kind of fits into our carrier interest group. It's really to look at things that are of interest to carriers. Things like remote management. It can be remote provisioning of services. It can be any number of things that features that are particularly of interest to carriers for their needs. So it's kind of a broad range of things, and we are looking to kind of get those what those features are, try to understand them better, and then try to see who in the community, if anyone, is able to add them as either an optional feature or if it has use to the community as a core addition. But that's certainly up to the community in that respect.
And by carrier here, you're particularly talking about things that we would normally call cable companies, as opposed to, say, phone companies, which the overlap is starting to really get crazy here. But but you're talking more about cable companies, right?
It's really either or. It depends. In Europe, it's even. I think it's mostly DSL there, is my understanding. But it's kind of either or. Both those groups have interest in this in this topic, and they want to use OpenWRT. It's very useful for them, and in lots of cases, they already do. But there are features and particular requirements. We want to make sure that those are available and done in an open source fashion that anyone can use them in the community, as well as people who just want to use it. You know, use it as something to inspire them to do something else. So,
and Neuromancer in the chat room actually brings up something that I was sort of aiming at as well, which is some level of number of nines of uptime, and this primarily being because this is customer facing, and they don't want their you know internet over you know video over internet on demand stuff to go away in the middle of the football game. Is there a particular focus that you're having to do on that as you're working with these carriers? To make sure that you've got very reliable things as well as featureful things?
We haven't talked too much about that topic yet. For the most part, these are mostly related to gateways. We haven't talked too much about the issue of things like cable boxes and TV and things like that. That's probably going to be an area that's going to become more common. You know, over time, people just, you know, they simply want to have less boxes and you know, combine them in different things. And there's lots of issues related to that. So, so far we haven't got too deeply into that topic. A lot of it has been related to the remote management, which is a project we're funding. We've had very, very minimal talks on the topic of, you know, what would simplify it, simplify the API for carriers from the manufacturers, and how can that relate to OpenWRT, whether it's like, for example, right now there's, while generally like to start up a Wi-Fi, start up a Wi-Fi network, that is a standard implementation in OpenWRT. I think you just do Wi-Fi on or Wi-Fi off or something along those lines. But to change the SSID is often at the software level is totally different between companies, and it doesn't stay the same over time. And so for carriers, that for their software, that's a pain because obviously they have to do retesting and they have to figure out what needs to be changed over time. So we've started, it's very early, but we've started to kind of talk with some of these, with the members of Purple who are from these chip makers and some of the carrier related companies to kind of talk about this and see, okay, can we go to the OpenWRT community and say, hey, this would be easier. How do we actually do this in a way that has value to everyone? and not come in with a solution that meets needs of one group or the other group, but kind of just see what would interest everyone. Can we simplify this? And if we simplify the API, kind of that abstraction layer, that's going to be of value to a lot of people. Because it's not just going to have value to the carriers, and it's not just going to have value to the chip makers. It's going to have value, I think, to the open source community as a whole. But I don't want to be like, oh, we're going to do this. We're still very early, but this has been a discussion we've talked about, and kind of just see what that kind of agreement and what would be in that, and then talk to the OpenWRT community as we do that to make sure that we have some agreement from everyone.
Eric, we got another question from the chat room from Neuromancer. Yep. He wants to know, how do you approach security given things like the massive DDoS on Brian Krebs that was in the news recently? What do you think about that?
Security, that is a very difficult topic. That actually talks about something that Purple is interested in, both in OpenWRT and outside of this. And it's not an area that I work as much on. We have other members of Purple that are and employees at Purple. Our chief security strategist, Cesare Agrelati, he's the guy that knows everything about this topic. One thing that is interesting that may be of interest to people is we recently released the Smart Home Security Report. It was a study that was funded by Purple that we had commissioned, and it talked to people in six different major companies like US, UK, Germany, Italy, France, and I believe Japan. Asked them what their thoughts were about security and IoT and security with routers. And by and large, there were some really interesting results, and that's you can see it at prpl.works right now. With some really interesting results was that people felt that they would pay more for security, which was actually a little bit surprising. They would actually welcome fewer features if there was more security. And the issue of that people, by and large, feel that they should be responsible for their own security, not the company's, which was kind of an interesting result that I'm not sure I expected. So I would encourage people to look at that and kind of just get a sense of what the organizations, what people are actually thinking. That kind of fits into our one of the other areas, our security and virtualization work. One of the ideas is the concept of security by separation. And that is, can you put parts of the software, each piece of software, in its own virtual machine? And this is kind of like taking Docker to an extra level. But like, let's say access to the Wi-Fi radio or through a particular piece of I/O is moved into a particular virtual machine, and then you have very clear interfaces to connect with it. You can do things like authorization, and you can say, oh, this virtual machine has access to this, but even if it's running as root inside its own virtual machine, it doesn't have access to the hardware necessarily if you don't want it to. So there's some really interesting stuff going on there, and I think that would be an area that would be great to get more people's feedback on, because we have a lot of companies in there. It'd be great to see other members of the community talk about that and see where there's some really interesting some use cases. I think one of the most interesting use cases, we're actually funding a project called Purple Hypervisor, and that's on GitHub, and it's a hypervisor that's mostly for very low power chips, very low power devices that are very they can't run Linux, for example. They run a real-time operating system. But in the case of a situation like you're running a factory and you want to have something that's connected to the internet and it has to do something, and you want to make sure that the hardware or the software is extremely locked down through your own key, potentially that is really valuable, so you don't have people like changing the software on your factory machine that is is welding cars or something. I don't know, but something like that, you need to have some assurance that these things haven't been modified. So that's kind of also an area that security and virtualization works on, and we have quite a few members that are very interested in this topic and have been experimenting with it and talking about some interesting ways to look at this problem.
You talk about having a bunch of members in Purple. Why do they go through Purple rather than trying to fund these projects themselves? What's the advantage of going through Purple?
I think the advantage that going through Purple is is we need a place to collaborate. A lot of people are doing doing things that are similar or are related they cover a lot of the same areas. I think one area is use the example of the TR069 project. We had a couple members when we asked for project ideas that we had a couple. We had Luca and Felix actually proposed creating their own TR069 stack, and then a couple of the members then said, "Oh, well, we think there should be an open source TR069 stack as well." And there were some people that weren't part of Purple, and they're like, "Oh, I heard about this. I think there should be. We should release our open source TR069 stack." And all of a sudden, you've got like four of these stacks that might be open sourced, and you're kind of like, we don't really need all of these. What is the problem that we're actually trying to solve? And we actually brought people together and we're like, okay, the TR069, the thing that actually parses the TR069 standard commands, that really isn't unique. What's unique is the idea of how do we put this into a framework to standardize remote management in general for that's particularly of use to telecom providers. And by coming together in Purple, it provides us a really good place to talk about these problems, bring people into one place and see, you know, let's not recreate, you know, the same progress, you know, the same ideas. Let's not, you know, reinvent the wheel. Let's see what's actually the problems in our industries, in the open source community, and in general, and see what we can actually do to bring our resources together in a way that's that's independent. Because Purple, while we're a member organization, we try to stay very independent and try to meet the needs of everyone we work with, and try to move everything forward.
Eric, let's switch gears a little bit. Related, it's something that Purple is bringing people together to talk about, and I've heard you say this a few times. The FCC might ban my operating system. What in the world? Tell me about that.
Yes. This has been – I've done this as part of Purple, and I've done this as part of my own personal interest. It's a very obscure topic. It has to do with how FCC is regulating Wi-Fi devices. It relates to the way that they're regulating Wi-Fi devices. They don't want people to be able to modify the frequencies and be able to operate in a manner that is outside the authorization. And that relates to what frequencies are allowed by the companies, because Wi-Fi frequencies vary by country. That's a little bit difficult because of that. Unfortunately, the way that they've been designed up to now, that it's handled in the Linux kernel. So the only way to prevent people from doing this is to then prevent people from modifying the Linux kernel, which means you've prevented people from doing anything with the device really at that point. You pretty much have to have the router, you have to use it from the manufacturer, which would be very serious to OpenWRT lead and really software freedom in general. We had discussed this topic. I've discussed this topic greatly. We've actually had a little bit of conversation with someone from the FCC I wouldn't say that they didn't understand it, but we helped them understand that there are consequences to the way that the regulation was proposed. And I think we're going to be trying to be a communication conduit as much as possible. If possible, we'd like to get groups of people from the community together to talk with them, because what they're trying to do is really not it's not this extremely like awful, unreasonable thing. It's like they just don't want people operating on frequencies that are not allowed by law. Whether that should be a technical solution or whether that should be a social, educating people don't do this. That's up in the air. Even if it's a technical solution, there are levels of ways this can be done to minimize the damage to software freedom and the ability of people to modify their hardware. So I think it's just getting people together and Purple. We're trying to be a conduit for that, and I'm doing it also in my personal life. I've spoken at a number of conferences on this topic. So.
So I thought we actually won this fight already. I remember a lot of things going back and forth, and it seemed like someone said, yes, we got the FCC to give a little bit more details, and we should be good to go now. What happened?
Oh, we won this fight. I don't want to – I mean, I think the FCC's they clearly have an interest in preventing interference between radio, and they have made some reasonably strong changes. They've changed some of their guidance so that it doesn't single out open source software, and they've made it more clear that it's specifically related to the radio frequencies. Unfortunately, that isn't really all that useful because it's still all done in the kernel right now. So if it's done in the kernel, you still have to lock down the kernel in that point. They also worked with I'm not sure in the company TP-Link maybe. TP-Link they had put some ability in one of their web UIs, their administration to actually allow people to modify the frequencies outside of authorization, so you could operate in a manner that's illegal in the U.S. And that is not allowed by their regulations. So therefore, the TP-Link settled the lawsuit that the FCC had brought against them, and they paid a fine. And they also were looking to they agreed as part of the settlement to work with the open source community to try to find a solution that it better meets the needs of everyone. We're still kind of in this up in the air because there's a lot of competing interests here. And I think the best way to really handle this is we would encourage people to both talk to the FCC and also talk with us, and just share your opinions. You know, what is a good solution to actually prevent people, whether it be through social, you know, just educating people on the laws, or in a technical manner to prevent them from operating in a way that's illegally? What's the best way to do this while trying to ensure that we can have open source innovation? Because many of the solutions that had been proposed and that we had heard from companies and from the FCC, not necessarily from the FCC, but were implied by them, they seem to prevent some important use cases. You know, when you start getting into regulating how you can modify the Wi-Fi firmware that bans things or that prevents innovation in things like mesh networking, which is used for disaster communication, and it's used for innovation and really interesting stuff that isn't being handled by mostly big companies, because mesh networking it's not something they sell to their customers. You sell a router, you're not talking about mesh networking, but it is supported by the standard, and by and large, community members have added that feature to Wi-Fi firmware over time. So it's understanding all the consequences of any idea and then trying to craft a solution, whatever it is, that meets as many needs as possible, and appreciates the fact that the FCC does have a requirement to minimize interference so that the any sort of radio communication doesn't interfere with anything else or other people using the same frequency.
So is kind of the worst case scenario solution that we're concerned about here, is it secure boot on routers? Is that kind of the potential end game?
Potentially. I mean, I'm secure boot in and of itself is, I think, someone like even Matthew, I'm zoning on his name. He's a member of the Free Software Foundation, but he's worked on secure boot. Secure boot in and of itself is not really a dangerous thing. It really comes down to who has the key. Is it your key or is it somebody else? That is a difficult thing to talk about and needs to be considered. And we need to have community members that are involved, because there's a completely legitimate use case for I own the key on the secure boot, and you can't install anything else. You can't install another operating system unless I've signed it. That's a very powerful thing, because that illuminates things like rootkits and things like that. In the worst case, having a key that is provided by a secure boot that is provided by some sort of some third party that restricts you how you can modify the router, I would call that not very good. But I think that is a potential end result that could happen. I think, and in that case, then I think that the community needs to share with regulators, and they need to share with the companies they buy from, and they need to share with a lot of people that, you know, if that causes problems, then you need to let them know that if that's not an acceptable solution for you or your use case, then they need to know that.
So, thinking about this from a different perspective, does this kill software-defined radio?
That is a very, very difficult answer. Software-defined radio, I never got into radio. I mean, my father is a ham radio operator, which actually helps me a little bit understanding what's going on. Software-defined radio has been it's completely legal. It's in a really weird state because they do technically require people to secure the radio against illegal modification. I'm not sure how well it's actually enforced. And not too many people actually distribute software-defined radios. They don't sell that many, from what I can tell. Does it kill software-defined radio? It certainly negatively influences it, I think, because it's going to require it's going to require people to think about a software-defined radio in a in its regulatory space a little bit differently, and I think that one thing that the FCC in general has struggled with is how to regulate software-defined radio, simply because it kind of messes with how they look at the world and their powers. And I don't want to get too much into the legal side of it, but the FCC in general regulates the sale of things, and the sale of things within certain buckets. Like for Wi-Fi, it's generally within Part 15. It's a regulation for consumer Wi-Fi, basically. And to them, they see it as, okay, consumers mostly are just using this thing, so we're going to regulate it a particular way. And software-defined radio, in particularly Part 15, it's like, okay, it's going to be in these particular frequencies, and it only does these things. Software-defined radio is weird because it can go into that. It can deal with Part 15 frequencies, but it can also deal with frequencies that are totally unrelated to Part 15 that are regulated under other parts of the regulation. Therefore, you need – and those have different sets of regulations for what are often completely reasonable reasons. So the question is, well, how does it comply with all of them? And the truth is, I don't know. And to some extent, I think the FCC struggled with this. So I think people who are interested in software-defined radios should also contact the FCC, contact people in your projects, and contact manufacturers to explain that, you know, these topics are interesting and they want to be part of the solution. Nobody wants people operating on frequencies they're not allowed to, that are illegal, that are endangering people's lives, but we also have technical problems and technical reasons why we might do certain things that that are legal but might not be allowed or able to do depending on how these regulations go forward in the future. So I think everyone needs to work together and be part of the solution on this topic. And I think everyone involved actually wants that. It's just getting people committed and involved and sharing their experiences.
Eric, somebody in the chat room just asked, why in the world is this such a big deal? Are we really going to blow up a building with the sound of our voice? And it reminded me of something I want to real quick get you to comment on. What was the original problem? Do you remember that the original problem the FCC cited, why they started this, why they changed the rules?
The FCC actually didn't cite anything very specifically. There's a couple different regulations. I'm not going to get into the detail. There are some that are actually in place right now, which are causing problems. They're also adding some that they want feedback on, and it's gets really complex into how this process happens. One area that they've been, I think, particularly concerned about is the issue of interfering on frequencies that are used by radar at airports. The Wi-Fi frequency in the middle of the Wi-Fi, the 5 gigahertz band, there is an area that's used by radars at airports. And to get around this problem, because these bands are very valuable, the FCC requires something called a digital frequency or dynamic frequency selection, DFS, that allows you to, if you're by an airport, it senses a signal and says, okay, we're not going to transmit on this frequency and you can't use this channel right now. That's not a particularly unreasonable feature to have on a router. It's quite reasonable. It'd be nice if these radars could be moved, but that's not feasible at all. So there were cases where people were interfering. Now, there were about 10 cases that they have reported. All of these cases were not done by individuals. They were done mostly by companies that were selling Wi-Fi access. Five of them were in Puerto Rico. I don't know what it is about Puerto Rico. But they were people that had these Wi-Fi routers that were selling access to people in the community. They were putting them on towers that were, dozens of feet in the air to try to transmit. And they were turning off DFS because they wanted to sell more access to more channels and therefore didn't have to have as many Wi-Fi routers. That is, to me, that's wildly irresponsible, and it was irresponsible, and it did interfere with these radars that are only rarely used for landing but does occasionally happen during bad weather. That said, it was only from companies. None of these were individuals that were experimenting, that were doing anything like that, and it only is used at about 45 airports in the U.S. This problem is in the debate in how much interference it causes. I've had people say that it causes tons of interference. I've had other educated people say, yeah, it barely interferes at all. I don't know enough about it to say otherwise. That said, I think this topic, this could be handled through some sort of social, educating people by legitimately, fining people if they're breaking the rules. If they're operating in these frequencies and interfering, whether that is enough to take draconian technical solutions, I don't personally think it is, but that I guess I don't sit in the FCC seat either. So
that was a very good comprehensive answer. We're almost out of time. Thank goodness. No, thank goodness. What am I saying? I totally mishandled that particular statement. Erase that. Scratch that. Reverse it. There we go. Since we're almost out of time, I do actually want to ask just a couple of quick questions that we have sort of outstanding. One, I've got to know why your Twitter handle is Eric Labor Day Schultz.
I switch it every month for something. So next month it'll be Eric Frankenschultz. That's my October.
Okay, that's a valid explanation. Also, we've covered a lot of stuff. We could probably keep talking for another hour or so based on what we've heard so far. We don't have another hour. So is there anything that we did not cover that you really wanted to make sure our audience got some experience with today?
The only thing is I wanted to – I mentioned the OpenWRT funding program. I want to emphasize that we want projects, proposals from the community. So if you're involved in OpenWRT, lead, or you think there's a proposal for improvements that would be valuable, I want to encourage you to go to prpl.works and look at the funding proposal description and look at some of the suggested ideas we have, but also come up with some of your own ideas and please submit them, because we would very much value it, and we want to fund people in the community who are doing interesting work and want to do interesting work in the future.
Awesome. That sounds great. And also a couple of questions that are my stock questions that I've been asking for years now, mostly as a sort of a thumb on the pulse of open source. Presuming you've done some development work recently, what's your favorite scripting language?
My favorite scripting language right now, Python. I really enjoy Python.
My God, I'm never going to get a Perl guy on here. Well, I'm going to keep getting Perl guys just to kind of offset the numbers.
I have used Perl, and I used it a long time ago, but I find it very difficult to read. It's so hard to read once you write it.
Oh, man, and I find the same thing about Python, but it's only because I don't understand it. So, I mean, anything you don't understand is hard to read, and I think that's something that people don't keep comprehending about Perl, is that Perl's not about, it's not about being hard to read. It's that you don't know how to read it. It's you, not Perl's fault. Anyway, long story. Now, here I go defending myself. Anyway, well, now let's try the other one. Let's see if I win on the next one. Probably not again. What's your favorite text editor?
I actually use Atom a lot.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, cool. I use Atom a lot. I've never been big into the Vim or Emacs. I just never got into them.
So. Yeah, we're actually going to have somebody talking about Electron and Atom up soon. They're on my very, very, very short list. So that'll be great because we've actually had a couple other projects also refer to that. Well, Eric, it's been wonderful having you on. Eric Labor Day Schultz, it's been wonderful having you on this show today. And I'm sure a lot more people will be interested in Purple now that they've heard about this. And we'll come and connect up with you. So thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you.
That was Eric Schultz, who is the community coordinator or something kind of like that. It scrolled off my screen, sorry, for the Purple Foundation. And Jonathan, what did you think?
Well, I'm kind of cheating. I know way too much about it. Like I said, I went to the OpenWrite convention paid for by Purple last year. But I think they are doing some important things. They're bringing together some of these commercial companies and the open source projects, OpenWRT specifically. You know, you've got things like the OpenWRT guys work on wireless drivers. They work on things in the Linux kernel. And if they're not careful, they kind of do it so isolated. None of those changes get pushed up to the kernel. None of those ideas get pushed back to the device manufacturers. And so it's a good thing for Purple to be able to kind of stand there in the middle and be the go-between between the open source guys and then the commercial guys. So I think they're doing a good service.
Yeah, it sounds like they're, as they like to say, filling a well-needed gap. Mm-hmm. A little backwards, but I like the malapropism there. It's great, and I'm glad. I believe you brought Eric to the show, right?
I did. He was on my list of contacts, and I saw that there weren't a whole lot of people scheduled over the next few weeks, so I hit him up with an email, and he said, sure, he'd be glad to come.
That's really great. We're glad we have co-hosts that are also like bringing guests forward. But you too can bring guests forward. But before I get to that, let me first speak about what I've been doing. I've been taking the guest suggestions that have been brought to me over the last week or so. I opened up all of Q4. So I have a lot more question marks on the big spreadsheet listed when you go to twit.tv/floss. There's a look at upcoming guest list. And I sent out a bunch of emails, and most of them actually replied within a day or two, which is really great, which means I scheduled, since we last chatted, since I last chatted with y'all, the audience, I scheduled 4 new guests. So let me talk about the new ones. Coming up next week, that's how quickly I had an opening. But on Wednesday, not Tuesday, we're getting bumped from our normal Tuesday slot to a Wednesday slot, same bat time, 9:30 a.m. Pacific time. We're going to be talking to the Frida or Frida Project. I don't know how to pronounce it. I'm going to guess it's Frida. Which to me looks very intriguing. You can inject JavaScript to explore native apps on Windows, Mac, Linux, iOS, and Android. Have you ever wanted to have an API into a proprietary program, like on your Android thing or on your Mac or whatever? This thing apparently can inject JavaScript to create APIs, add functionality, explore the data that's inside of it. This looks like it could be an interesting game changer, and I'm glad they're going to be talking to us next Wednesday. I remember something similar to this just for OS X and iOS, called FScript, that would inject Smalltalk into applications. And since Smalltalk and the Objective-C object model were fairly close, that was actually a pretty good match to be able to inject that sort of stuff. But Frida, coming up next Wednesday, set your clocks a day later if you're watching the live show, because we're not going to be on next Tuesday. We're going to be on next Wednesday. After that, Linux Presentation Day, which we've had on the schedule for a while. It's basically a Europe-wide intro to Linux days happening in multiple cities in Europe. Just added to the schedule, Chick Tech, which is we've actually had one of the guests already on speaking to us about Texas Linux Fest because she was involved with that. Unfortunately, I didn't write her name here, but we're going to be talking. Their primary purpose is dedicated to retaining women in the technology workforce and also getting more people interested in being technology of the women persuasion. Also just added to the list, MetaBrains. That's community-maintained databases. You might know them from their initial project, but they've added a lot more. Their initial project was MusicBrainz, and I remember downloading this software. It would actually look at unlabeled MP3s that I had and figure out what album and track they were from, similar to what say Soundhound and I forget the other one, Soundhound and Shazam are doing these days, where you can play a segment of it and it figures out what it is. But this is all open source, and they've expanded to a number of other things. Again, open source technology, but also open source data. And I like it when we can overlap both of those. They're coming on soon, about 3 weeks, I guess. And then another one that I had to make sure that I was going to be on your phone. Oh My ZSH. Now, ZSH is a very popular open source shell. I often complain that if ZSH had been around, Larry wouldn't have invented Perl, because it seems to be sort of semantically sharing a similar space to basic shells and things like that. So it'll be sort of fun. Oh My ZSH is a tool for managing your ZSH configuration, which can get quite wieldy. And also has a lot of different things for a lot of different common situations in ZSH and stuff. I am really looking forward to not only interviewing them, but also being someone who might be using that software sometime soon. Again, you can see all these. And we're rescheduling the Karina show. That would have been, I think, last week or this week. Maybe next. No, it would have been next week. We're rescheduling that, but don't worry. We will be having them on. It's an easy-to-use, instant-on, native container environment from Rackspace. They will be on back again shortly. I've got a bunch of stuff from the Red Hat Summit that I'm still scheduling. I just sent out requests for the Ansible project. I like Ansible. It's got some interesting features to it, basically being a serverless configuration management setup. Also over to manage IQ and OpenShift Origin and Gluster, all in that category of things I saw at the Red Hat Summit. So I am Red Hat Summit, not quite Red Hot. That's something entirely different. Still booking Q4. Still got some open slots. If you have a project that is not on my list yet, not on my radar, being interfered with the Wi-Fi things, right? Please email the community coordinator or the project leader, whatever you feel is appropriate, particularly if you're participating in the project. This is easier. And have them email me, merlin@stonehenge.com. If you forget that address, if you go to twit.tv/floss, the homepage for this page, it's right there in big, bold letters. We do a live stream typically 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Tuesdays at live.twit.tv. We took a number of questions from the audience today. Now, again, next Wednesday, not next Tuesday. So please make a note of that for that week only. Back to Tuesdays following that. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google Plus and at Floss Weekly. That gets tweeted over to on Twitter. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus. That's my primary source for blogging these days. And that gets tweeted over at Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, and also over to my Facebook account. So you can see what I'm posting there. I have been interviewed by the Code Maven open source podcast. That's at code-maven.com/CMOS, just like the technology. Gabor Szabo is a big Perl community participant and leader, and he started this podcast. He's had the Code Maven website for quite a while, blog for quite a while. Now he's actually started the podcast. It'll be not immediately. I'm still behind maybe one or two other interviews that he's done, but sometime this week, next week, you can go there to that site I just mentioned and get the RSS feed. And John, if you want to bring up that picture for a second, while I was over the weekend, I ordered this wonderful burger. And if you're watching the video, John almost has brought the picture. There it is. All right. And if you can't see the video, it is a giant bun with like a ton of meat and cheese on it. It's basically a half-pound burger with super cheese, pastrami, bacon, everything. It was absolutely delicious. But I want to make a comment for people that have been following my way of eating. People were complaining. They're saying, oh, that's a heart attack on a bun. And I said, no, it's actually only the bun that's going to give me a heart attack, because that increases my triglycerides and hardens my arteries. The actual meats that are all inside that were all completely on my diet, legal. And by the way, I lost weight over the weekend, even having eaten stuff like that. So, boy, if you want to find out more about low-carb, high-fat, go back to some previous shows and or just to Google ketogenic or low-carb, high-fat. That's all the plugs I want to do. Jonathan, what are you plugging today?
Nothing to plug today. We are plugging away at work and okay. Getting some things done, but nothing to announce.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining me on today's show. As always, you're welcome to join whenever we have the slots available. And you do a wonderful job. So thank you for also bringing the guest today.
Yep, it's my pleasure. I enjoy getting to do it.
Awesome, Jonathan. And to all you out there, we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.